Welcome to Learning Technology Unplugged. In this podcast, I'm going to be talking to Lynn Clowder, the Director of the Centre for Interprofessional E-Learning, or CIPEL for short. CIPEL is one of 74 centres of excellence in teaching and learning, funded by the Higher Education Funding Council for England in 2005. They invested over £300 million in the centres as a way of recognising and rewarding existing excellence and trying to stimulate growth and development in those areas. The vision was that these centres would go on to create change across the sector and improve the standards of learning and teaching. This was a really interesting initiative for several reasons. For a start, the format was completely different from almost any other kind of research funding at the time. HEFCE also promised a light-touch process of audit and evaluation, and the idea of this was that people could concentrate on building their understanding and carrying out activities rather than worrying the whole time about processes of monitoring. The overall agenda was to achieve sector-wide change in terms of learning and teaching, but exactly how this was going to happen was left up to the settlers. So it was a very ambitious investment, and it's currently drawing to a close, so I thought it'd be interesting to try and find out more about what it's been like to do research in that kind of context. So here's Lynn talking about her experiences. Okay, so thanks very much for agreeing to do this. Could you just start by saying what your CETL is and what your role in it is?
Well, the CETL is the Centre for Interprofessional E-Learning, CIPEL, as we become known. It's a collaborative CETL between Coventry University and Sheffield Hallam University. So one of a fairly small number of collaborative CETLs, which I think is quite interesting in itself. Its remit was to explore whether interprofessional learning could be delivered through the use of technology. Rather than talking about interprofessional learning, IPL, we talk about interprofessional e-learning, so using technology.
Could you just say a bit about what interprofessional learning is? Because don't want to assume that everyone who's listening will know about that.
Yeah, sure. Interprofessional learning is a type of learning and working, particularly in the health and social care context, is where it's been sort of particularly adopted. Although obviously, you know, people work interprofessionally in other professions, in architecture, building, construction, those sorts of areas. But in health, it's seen as particularly important in terms of promoting the best outcomes for service users and patients. There's been lots of kind of high-profile cases where lack of communication and lack of working together really has resulted in fairly disastrous consequences. And as a result of that, there's been a call for better team working, collaborative working, inter-agency, interprofessional working. So there's lots of kind of, there's a big government driver, I suppose, to promote interprofessional learning in pre-qualification education. And then obviously, you know, ideally in the workplace as well, although I think that probably there's less of that going on than is actually happening in undergraduate education. So that's what interprofessional learning and working is. Right. It's traditionally been delivered in a face-to-face context, so on training wards, getting students to work with scenarios face-to-face, and that type of approach. And the unique sort of take of the CETL was to actually see if we could use technology, so getting students to collaborate online and working with triggers, scenarios, to actually get them discussing things that might be more difficult to discuss actually in a face-to-face setting. It was perceived that e-learning might offer ways of overcoming some of the barriers to face-to-face interprofessional learning, like students not wanting to voice their opinions in an interprofessional mixed group, and some of the practical issues like the logistics of getting students together en masse, and some professions, some courses having lots of students, whereas other courses were relatively tiny, and how you got contact between students on those sort of different courses. So e-learning was perceived to be a means of actually overcoming a lot of those barriers, and that was the kind of the unique focus of the CETL. There were several aspects envisaged to sort of strands of activity envisaged when the settler was actually established. One of the main strands was to produce resources that would support interprofessional e-learning. So the idea of producing learning objects that might be very simple trigger objects or knowledge objects, or more complex scenarios that we could then get students to talk around and discuss and do activities around, hence promoting collaboration. So a big emphasis on producing good, sort of authentic and qualitative resources. Another aspect was obviously to engage stakeholders. Interprofessional learning has been quite contentious, and, you know, there are some people who are quite resistant to working interprofessionally. So a big part of our work was to actually, you know, gain people's sort of confidence, I suppose, in the idea that interprofessional working is a sort of a gainful sort of occupation, when people are usually so focused on, you know, doing profession-specific teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. And then part of our activity then would be to disseminate our findings and our resources that we developed to the wider community, and to contribute to the evidence base in terms of, you know, interprofessional e-learning and what it had to offer. So they were our sort of strands of activity. The team was obviously based in two different institutions, so the team was divided between the two institutions, and each of the two teams were made up of academic staff, learning technologists and professional services staff. So we had to be quite inventive in making sure that we kept good contact and communicated well, certainly in the early stages of the Settle initiative.
I want to come back to one of the points, which was the kind of reasons for using e-learning in this. Now, I mean, a lot of the time when e-learning is researched and talked about, what people are concerned with is doing things faster or doing more things, you know, so they're looking for improvement in student test scores.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're looking for things like more flexible engagement, so, you know, can mature and part-time students join in a way they couldn't before.
Yeah.
But the kind of things you're talking about are qualitatively different, so it's about giving a different kind of experience to people and bring them together in a different kind of way. And that strikes me as something quite distinctive about what you've described there.
Yeah, the idea of getting people together online is quite important, I think, in our particular context, because there is quite a hierarchy in health and social care, and some students have traditionally had less of a voice than others. Hmm. And e-learning actually gives the opportunity for everyone to have an equal voice, because actually it's totally online. The students never actually meet one another, although they might by chance, I guess, but generally they don't actually know who they're talking to. They might know that they're talking to a physiotherapist or an OT or a medic. But actually the students who are quite often silenced in face-to-face contact do actually develop a voice online, and that's supported by, you know, wider research. So this seemed to be a good opportunity to actually tap into that potential, to make sure that actually everybody did have a voice. And actually that does seem to happen. Students, you know, we get youth work students talking to medical students, talking to social workers, and actually, you know, maybe that's not so easy to make happen in a real life situation, even in the working context, but actually students have experienced it here, you know, as part of their undergraduate training. So that has to be a positive thing, because, you know, working on the idea that the contact hypothesis proposes that actually it's about having contact with people. When you have had contact with people, then you understand what they're about, you understand their roles, and then you're more likely to actually interact with them and communicate with them and collaborate. That sort of backs up that theory, really.
So that's what the Settle's been setting out to do. What's your role in it been?
Well, I set out, I was appointed in 2005 as an associate director in the Settle, and I thought I was coming in to do creative work around generating resources and doing some pedagogical research. At the same time, I actually took on a half-time, I was 0.4 in the Settle at that point. I also took on a research fellowship, a pedagogical research fellowship in our Centre for the Study of Higher Education at Coventry. So the two roles seem to be quite complementary, really. However, our then director, Ann Davidson, fell ill, and I was actually asked to be acting director sort of shortly after we got the settled status. And unfortunately, Ann died in March 2006, so I actually became director of the settle, which changed my remit somewhat. So my role, I guess, has been to try to steer a way through this initiative and through the collaboration, and to be an ideas person, to be, head cook and bottle washer, really. You name it, and I've done it, I suppose. So what I envisaged was quite different to what actually came about in the end. In terms of where Anne would have taken it, I think Anne was very much a technology person. I didn't claim to be a technology person at all when I came in. I was more interested in I wanted to know more about e-learning, and I was interested in interprofessional learning. I'd taught some interprofessional modules. But I'm also interested in doing pedagogical research. I think that probably Anne would have driven it down a more technology route, maybe. Anne might have been more into the resource development aspects of things, I don't know. Whereas I think that my interests are perhaps not specifically about resources and, talking about things like metadata and repositories and things. I mean, it's interesting, and I understand it all a lot more now, but my interests were really more on the pedagogical research side, I guess. So Anne actually, Anne's death actually changed things quite considerably for me, and probably for the whole settle, actually. Yeah.
So you talked about a couple of different areas of research there. There is that sort of the reusable learning objects, the reuse agenda. There's also the pedagogic research agenda.
Yeah.
What kinds of research have you been able to do within that?
We've done, I suppose, quite a bit of empirical research around interprofessional e-learning. And right from the beginning, there's always been a bit of a tension, really, in that, we've got this divided focus, or sometimes it feels divided. So it's not pure e-learning. It's not pure interprofessional learning. It's trying to bring two quite complex areas together. So in a way, our research has maybe been sort of very specific to that field, and almost it makes you feel like maybe you're not fully part of the e-learning community, and you're not fully part of the interprofessional learning community, and you're trying to sort of bridge a gap really between the two, which is good, but it feels sometimes like there's not many other people working in a similar area. We've done empirical research. I would like to have done more comparative stuff, but that's not really come off. Although we might have an opportunity to do that in the near future, in that we've got three universities in Trent who are interested in using some of our resources and possibly using them in a different way, which would give us the opportunity to actually compare totally online delivery with blended, with maybe face-to-face, which would be really exciting. So that would be good if we can do that. I'm interested in reflective practice, and I would like to have done more in terms of the reflexive stuff on where the settle's taken us, how it's actually worked, how the collaboration's worked. But that hasn't occurred. Well, a little bit of that has happened. I would like to have done more of that, but really, I guess, in a way, the substantive area of our focus is maybe more important at this point of time. Maybe we'll write up some of the reflexive stuff later. I don't know. The other thing that I don't think we've done enough of, and which I would have liked to have done, is to think more about the concepts that we're working with and some of the theoretical research that we might do. And almost that's still there. That's still a possibility, and that's something that I'd really be interested in, because, I am interested in theoretical research. I like the empirical stuff, but I think that conceptual theoretical research has got a place. So that might be something that we move on to, or I move on to later. We've provided funding for quite a few people who had not done research before, and that's been really exciting, because it's meant that people have had a taste of what doing research or evaluation is about, And, you know, many of those people are now getting into writing up that research for the first time. And so that's all really exciting. So I think, you know, we've started off with quite small, discrete projects in places that have, you know, starting to come to fruition. So I think we've covered quite a few areas. I mean, there's lots that we haven't done, and there's lots that we'd still like to pursue. We've got lots of data that, you know, is sitting there waiting to be addressed, but it's how you balance the research with all the other sort of commitments, really, in terms of, you know, the service delivery aspects of the settle, and now sort of trying to bring in funds to keep things going, to make us look like we're viable and that we're an active, you know, applied research unit. Yeah.
I mean, that the thing that you've just mentioned, this sort of tension between the service function and the research function, is something I think a lot of the settles are trying to grapple with. So yeah. There is a sort of pull towards the very visible, externally oriented research profile,
yeah,
and being seen to be useful internally. And obviously, you know, yeah, in terms of the exit strategies and sustainabilities, if you're not supported internally, if you're not seen to be valuable internally, you know, that's going to be very hard to keep these things going.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about trying to achieve a balance, isn't it? And being quite strategic, I suppose, of knowing when to, you know, when to flag up the things that you can, how you can contribute, I suppose. Because, you know, people don't see opportunities for you. You have to see them. Mm-hmm. And that you need to be quite tuned into, you know, what's going on in your own institution to be able to do that. But to do that, it takes a lot of groundwork to keep up to speed with what's happening. I mean, I think that the income generating stuff is always going to be difficult to sort of to not do, if you like, because, you know, like all at universities, you know, we're all sort of trying to keep afloat in these sort of stretching financial times. And, you know, there is a risk, obviously, that the more sort of creative work gets pushed down to the bottom of the list if there's an opportunity to bring in money that might not be so creative but actually keeps people afloat and keeps people in their jobs. But in terms of service delivery, I think that you're almost a victim of your own success, because as people get to find that they can use, you know, some of the approaches that you've been espousing and trying to embed, then they come back and they want to do more. And it's tricky, really, because, you know, you can encourage people to do things themselves, and to a certain extent they can do things themselves, but they also need to be able to tap into the expertise of learning technologists to do things that look attractive and, you know, things that they think will stretch students a bit further and, you know, really sort of make their modules more interactive. And so you get more people coming to you as you become more successful. You get busier and busier and busier. And, you know, the research, there's always that risk that the research is the thing that gets put onto the back burner, like it does with most academic staff. You know, their scholarly work is the bottom of the list, isn't it? They've got all their other demands made on them. And, you know, it's a case of trying to pull it back up the list and making sure that people recognise that it is important to be seen to be, you know, doing scholarly work and publishing and getting out and disseminating work. So it's difficult.
The tension that you've been talking about, this sort of pull between the internal and the external work, this is something that Hefke wrote into the plan for the settles from the outset.
Yeah.
It was part of a sort of act of faith on their part, almost, that this kind of hybrid venture would work to change things across the sector.
Yeah.
Having got through this process, having lived it for a number of years now, do you think they were right to try and design it like that?
Well, I think it's fair that, you know, you give people a pot of money to try to do some work to promote the evidence base. I think it's only fair that you then share that evidence base and share your experiences with the wider community. So, yes, I do think that Hefke were right. I think, interestingly, what we found is that getting known externally has actually promoted how people view us internally. And I think I've heard one or two other people say similar things, actually, that it's only when people go to conferences and someone maybe approaches them and says, oh, you know, there's some good work going on in your institution, that those people come back and say, oh, you know, so-and-so mentioned you at this conference, and which is very interesting, isn't it, how it works. It's almost like you can't be a prophet in your own land, really.
Exactly.
So I think that, you know, yes, I do think it's fair that the wider sector have been given a sort of, we've been given a remit to disseminate to the wider sector. you know, obviously, if we're doing things that, that we think are becoming sort of good practice, then it's good to be able to share them, isn't it? You know, it's good that, you know, you have got something to go, a message to go out to tell other people. And, you know, you might get some feedback from them when they've tried those approaches to say, actually, you know, we found this works. And that's how you generate sort of networks and communities, isn't it, around interest areas.
But there's something quite different between the settles and, you know, a conventional project would be expected to disseminate at the end of it. And increasingly, yeah, these projects are being asked to sort of go to audiences outside of just other academics and researchers.
Yeah.
But the settles, I mean, they were given the job of actually working within their institutions and changing practice locally as well as, yeah, changing things nationally. And I think it's quite different to try and do that work at home, as it were,
yeah,
rather than just in this sort of general sense across the sector.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it was incredibly hard work getting things kick-started here at Coventry. You know, we felt very much out on a limb. We're in a building that's divorced from our main faculty building. No one knew where we were or what we really were about. So we had to do an awful lot of work in actually selling ourselves and our own institution. And I think it was quite different maybe at Sheffield Hallam, where they had more of a sort of a history of trying to promote interprofessional learning. Here, we were really felt like we were starting from scratch. Yeah, it was not easy, but actually, you know, we're quite well embedded now, I would have said, and that feels really good, that feels really positive.
Coming across from what you've been saying about things like where the building is and how connected you are, there's also a lot of stuff about the settled research work, which is a lot more political than a conventional,
yeah,
project would be. I mean, the things you were mentioning earlier about having to be really tapped into what's happening in the institution, having to constantly think ahead for sustainability,
yeah,
these aren't things that a conventional research project would have to engage with.
No, maybe not. Because I suppose a conventional research project would come to an end, wouldn't it? There would be a finite end date, and then, you know, obviously you disseminate, but really that's it. People tend to move on to other projects. You know, I mean, the Settle Initiative, at the very beginning, there were sort of noises to say that this shouldn't be considered to be a project. And I think we've never looked at it as a project, really. We've looked at it as an initiative, a change initiative, that actually we've sort of envisaged carrying on. So, you know, it didn't feel like it was going to ever come to an end. Maybe that was being too optimistic. I'm a born optimist, but... initially we thought we wouldn't get any backing to continue, and then probably about 18 months ago the tide seemed to turn and people started to recognise the contribution we were making and seeing that we could actually, you know, continue to move things forward, maybe on a slightly wider sort of basis, but actually, you know, it wasn't going to come to an end. So I suppose in a way, you know, maybe we've had more invested interest in the idea of, okay, so if this is going to be sustainable, you know, how we're going to make it sustainable, what sorts of things do we need to offer. So maybe we've made more of an effort because there was just that sort of potential to continue. Mm. Yeah.
But it's also interesting, you said about 18 months ago this is what happened, and you,
yeah,
think about the settles were quite distinctive in that they were a five-year block of funding.
Yeah.
Normally projects are finished after 3 years at best.
Yeah.
You know, and all what, sure, you've just described, a three-year project wouldn't have got to the point where other,
no,
people started to recognise its value.
Yeah, that's it. I think, I mean, 5 years is no time, really. You know, if you're trying to instigate change doesn't happen fast.
Hmm.
And I think that, you know, one of the things that we found probably within about the first 18 months, 2 years, people were sort of pushing and pushing, you know, to say, you know, well, what, you know, what have you found? What are your outputs? You know, they wanted the deliverables. And actually... Hmm. It took us, I would say, the first 2 years, really, to get established, to start to get known, to win people's confidence and trust. And it was only after about 3 years that it really felt like we started to move things forward. So, yes, I mean, how people cope on shorter projects, you know, I really don't know. But it feels like now, when we're coming up to the five-year sort of period, we've got so much to offer that really, in a way... you know, we're only just starting to sort of, you know, to start to really come up with the outputs and come up with some good sort of ideas and theories and suggestions of how practice might be changed. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That, you know, you think 5 years is forever when you set off, but actually the time goes so quickly. Yeah.
Having got to the end of it, I mean, do you feel it's all been worthwhile?
Oh, phenomenally, yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely worthwhile. It's been a tremendous opportunity. We've been very, very sort of lucky to have been given the opportunity. I think that, you know, if I think about the institution now, you know, it has changed. We have made an impact. The change is quite palpable. And there's a consultation document going out on SIPL at its sort of in its end phase. And the people who I've spoken to are all so positive. So, yes, I mean, we've all learned so much. And, you know, interprofessional e-learning is there on the map now.
Mm-hmm.
We've written a book. It's my opportunity to plug the book, the SIPL book. But we put out a call to see if there were other people around the world interested in interprofessional e-learning and researching and evaluating it, thinking that we wouldn't get any responses very much. And we actually got quite a good response. We've got something like 32 chapters from people in about 6 countries. That's due out in April. So that's really exciting. And, you know, it's really wonderful to think that we are sort of part of this movement to actually, you know, get into professional learning online. So that's been really exciting. So, yes, it's been a tremendous experience. And, you know, I think we'll all take away so much that we've learned from it. And hopefully we'll have the opportunity to use, you know, our sort of skills and capabilities in whatever happens next.
You know, this has been quite an interesting, quite an unusual commitment of money from Hefke. It's quite a strange design for a way of investing money in the sector. It's quite odd as a research project. Do you think we'll ever see anything that's quite like this again?
I don't know. I mean, I think that in a way, Hefke were very freeing. You know, one felt quite freed and able to take risks, and we were encouraged to experiment.
Mm.
And almost our institutions found that quite frightening. They had to put parameters on it. It has to be treated as a business case, and, you know, there had to be sort of very sound objectives and what have you. And it was managed very carefully, I think, certainly, you know, because there was always this suggestion, you know, Hefke say this, but actually, you know, we know better. They'll come back, you know, it'll come back and bite us. They don't really mean us to have all this freedom and what have you. But actually, I sort of think probably they did. And I think, you know, you tend to think that maybe Hefke would be, you know, sort of fairly rigid in its thinking on the in these ways. But actually, I think they did mean us to sort of go and do something creatively. I suspect it probably won't happen again because there's been a lot of criticism of it. And already Hefke have moved on, their agenda's moved on. But it has been a tremendous opportunity. And I think one of the big things is that it's just made space for people, you know, people who perhaps are doing the pedagogical research or doing the development stuff, but not, you know, sort of getting recognition for it, not sort of having the space to actually explore things fully, has been a tremendous, tremendous opportunity. It's been a lot of money, but I think that actually, you know, I would hope that the final evaluation would show that there's been phenomenal change across the sector. And, you know, if that evaluation was convincing enough, maybe Hefke would consider doing it again. I don't know. I think that obviously they have got political masters as well, haven't they? And not least the institutions who seem to frown on anything that's sort of not kind of is a bit different, I suppose.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap this up?
Don't think so. No, okay. I think that's it.
Thanks ever so much for doing that. That's much appreciated. You can find SIPL's website at www.sipl.ac.uk. The book that Lynn mentioned is called Interprofessional E-Learning and Collaborative Work, Practices and Technologies. It's published by IGI Global. It should be out in April 2010 as both a book and an e-book. There'll be information and links to the SETL and the book from the Learning Technology Unplugged website at ltunplugged.wordpress.com. That's it for this podcast.
Next time I'll be talking with Richard Hall from De Montfort University about the role of social media in higher education, and specifically what that might be in the context of a world facing significant disruption. Find out more about what that might be, and feel free to ask some questions at the blog site. My heart is breaking, I can close my eyes, it's already here.